ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुर्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 6, Text 15. Srila Prabhupada begins his purport by warning against unauthorized processes of meditation. In the modern age, there are many unauthorized processes of meditation. That meditation is a spiritual process is well known, at least within Hinduism and Buddhism. Now in the Western countries, it's also. But what is the actual process? The actual process is as was practiced in Satya Yuga, particularly as was practiced in Satya Yuga. And that meditation was specifically upon Lord Vishnu. Dhyana avastita tatgatena manasa pashantiyam yoginaha. In the condition of dhyan, the yogis see him, the supersoul, Govinda. But there are also many unauthorized processes of the Patanjali system of yoga is very famous. That is generally known as Ashtanga yoga, in which dhyan is the crucial point. There is yama, niyama, pranayama, pratyahara, all these initial processes, which are, that means following the prescribed processes and avoiding those things which are not to be done. And third is asana, I didn't mention. Sitting properly. Pranayama, control of the breath, is a very simplified description of pranayama. And pratyahara, withdrawing the mind from the sense objects. Then comes the stage of dhyana. And that dhyana becomes focused in dharana or clear concepts. And then there is the stage of yoga siddhi, which is called samadhi. This Ashtanga yoga system is alluded to or described somewhat in Bhagavad Gita by Lord Sri Krishna. Whether or not the system as described by Patanjali is exactly that which Krishna describes, that is contestable. Because Patanjali is ultimately, what he has suggested is not Vishnu Bhakti at all. He states that meditation should be upon Ishvara, but his ultimate concept is impersonal. That Ishvara, he describes, there's some function in meditation upon Ishvara. He has some functional purpose. Ishvara has some functional purpose. He's not absolute, but he has a functional purpose. I don't know how to say in Tamil. Maybe someone else can. So if we see his philosophy, we may think that it is theistic. But actually it's not. That he takes the meditation on God only for a certain purpose, and when you've done that, then there's no need for it. So the Ashtanga yoga system, or the system of dhyan that was followed in Satya yoga, it appears to be not exactly that which Patanjali has described. It may be very similar, but somewhere along the line Patanjali has hijacked the whole process. Because the actual system of dhyana, as is being practiced by Narad Muni here, is supposed to lead to bhakti. And as such, the dhyana performed by Narad Muni is bhakti. Bhaktya sanjataya bhaktya, bhakti leads to bhakti. No, nothing else but bhakti can give bhakti. Karma cannot give bhakti. Jnana cannot give bhakti. Only bhakti can give bhakti. Janma koti sukritayana labhyate. Even millions of lifetimes of performing mundane pious activities cannot give Krishna bhakti rasa bhavitamatihi, Krishna consciousness. So that may sound very strange. Bhakti can get bhakti. Well, if you already have bhakti, then how do you get bhakti from it? This means that beginning stage of bhakti, vaidhi bhakti, that will ultimately lead to shuddha bhakti, or pure devotion, full prema bhakti. The full manifestation of bhakti is prema bhakti. So the meditation that Narad Muni performed, that led to prema bhakti. But by following the process of Pantanjali, one will never attain to prema bhakti. Even though it, in most aspects, it seems the same process. But because Patanjali, from the beginning, does not understand that the goal is prema bhakti, he has directed his followers to a different goal. So, therefore, if you aim for one attainment, you will. If you aim for a certain attainment, then you are likely to get that. You won't attain something else. There is a totally bogus so-called philosophy, which is very popular in the modern age. Jato mat tato pat. All paths lead to the same goal. This is sometimes translated. Now, when we point out that this is totally bogus, sometimes people get upset because they consider it to be a divine pronouncement of a great Paramahamsa. They consider it to be the divine pronouncement of a great Paramahamsa, Divyavani, you can say. However, if we examine it, we will find that it is absolutely bogus. So it's not wrong to say that. Even if someone has a reputation as a highly saintly person, if he's talking nonsense, then we should recognize that. Now, how are we to judge who is who and what is what? That we have to judge by the standard of Shastra and by that of the great Acharya. Now we find in Bhagavad Gita that Lord Krishna gives his most important instruction, Savadhaman Parityaja Mam Ekam Sharanam Vraja. So he says, Mam Ekam, you surrender to me only. Mam Ekam Sharanam. So if we say that all paths lead to the same goal, it's actually quite different to what Krishna says. And therefore we have to conclude that it's totally bogus. It doesn't make any sense anyway. Just like, for instance, if you study to be an engineer, can you become a doctor? Einstein might have been a brilliant scientist, but he didn't know how to cook chapatis. If someone had taught him to cook chapatis, he could probably learn, but he didn't know. So, as a hypothesis, these kind of hypotheses are popular with scientists. As a hypothesis, hypotheses are popular with scientists. If Einstein had walked into the kitchen where, and his wife probably never heard of chapatis, but she said, he volunteered to cook chapatis, and then we say, no, not you. Bring any uneducated village woman from Rajasthan, let her cook chapatis. She'll be better than Einstein. Maybe we should say dosa. So, Einstein is a brilliant scientist, no doubt, but we can say that, bring some... Alright, we'll stick with Einstein. But who would you rather cook dosai for breakfast? Einstein or your wife? Well, some of you don't have wives, so it's a theoretical question. Anyway, the point is that although Einstein was considered to be a brilliant scientist, because of that, it doesn't mean that he's perfect in everything. So it's not that all paths lead to the same goal or all studies lead to the same perfection. Someone says, I need bypass surgery, it's going to cost 2 lakhs, but I don't have the money. So if someone says, well, I'm an expert auto rickshaw driver, I'll do it for you for 20,000 rupees only. So, well, no thank you. Why not? You'll save so much money. It's an absurd proposition. So although one may have followed one area or become expert in one area, doesn't mean that he has any, even the slightest knowledge in another area. The same way you'd rather have the uneducated auto rickshaw driver drive the rickshaw than have a heart surgeon who doesn't know how to drive do so. Otherwise you'll need to see a doctor. So the proposition that all paths lead to the same goal doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But this is very widely propagated in the modern age. Therefore, Prabhupada writes here, one should not meditate according to one's personal whims. It is a common misconception that in spiritual life we can just take to it as we like. And most of the modern so-called gurus pander to this fantasy. They'll give some so-called initiation with no instruction, no rules to follow. Or even if they give some rules to follow, they don't know what the actual purpose of life is, which is to surrender to Krishna. It's definitely the workings of Maya that in our supposedly scientific age, that people are so unscientific when it comes to spiritual life. That you'll find even people who are highly qualified scientists, they accept some ridiculous so-called Baba as God, for instance. It's just an example. So they have scientific training, but they don't have the sense to apply the scientific method when it comes to spiritual life. If we are to accept someone as Bhagawan, we should test what are the symptoms. But there is this misconception that, well, spiritual life, it's just beyond any kind of ordinary understanding. Therefore, whatever you feel like, that is spiritual. Now, certainly the role of subjective consciousness is essential in spiritual understanding. Subjective consciousness. I don't know how to say it in Tamil. If you don't, I'm stuck. Feelings. All right, let's just say feelings. Intuition. But that has to be checked against, or rather guided by Shastric understanding. It is true that in bhakti, one's ultimately feelings and emotions are most important. Bhakti is not meant simply to make us into philosophers, but bhakti means love of Krishna. However, if our in the initial stages, which goes on for quite a long time, if our feelings are not guided by Shastra, by Shastric understanding and by following the rules and regulations of Shastra, then we will mistake our mundane emotions to be bhakti. Therefore, we have to follow the process given by the acharyas, and according to which is that given in Shastra. If we act according to personal whims, then we will not attain bhakti. Ya Shastra vidhim utsrija vartate kama karataha nasa siddhim avapnoti nasukham naparam gatim. This is a very important verse from Srimad Bhagavad Gita. You all need to learn this for preaching to others. Because so many people can bring so many different ideas. But we have to tell them, you have to follow Shastra. Of course, another problem comes when people say, yes, we are following Shastra, and our conclusion, and they come out with something bogus. And then we have to come to Shastra Vichar. Vicharam, Charcha. But most people in the modern age, they just subscribe to something which is totally away from anything in Shastra. Sometimes these, or usually these totally bogus gurus, they introduce the teaching of the Upanishads or something, but they have no connection with that whatsoever. Or often they like to train, they have their followers train their children in learning Bhagavad Gita shlokas. And the foolish people think, oh yes, you see, this is Shastra. But they don't try to understand what is the meaning of these shlokas. If we understand the meaning of Shastra, then we'll never subscribe to these bogus gurus who do not teach that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. These people are often very tricky, because sometimes they may say, yes, Krishna is supreme, or Vishnu is supreme. But then they'll say that, yes, Vishnu is a manifestation, he's a embodied manifestation of the Supreme, which is ultimately impersonal. Or they'll say that, yes, Vishnu is supreme, and also Brahma is supreme, and Mahesh is supreme, and you are supreme and we are all supreme, and it's totally meaningless. Because supreme by definition means asama or dva. No one is equal, no one is superior, no one is above. If everyone says it, if anyone says, well, everyone is supreme, we can immediately understand this person is a rascal. Because it's a totally meaningless statement. Supreme means above all others, so how can everyone be above all others? There must be one only who is supreme by definition. So you have to be very careful of these crocodiles posing as sadhus. Crocodile? Why crocodile? Because the crocodile just sits in the river and looks very peaceful. Looks like a real sadhu. But any chance and he'll snap you up. He doesn't have any... It appears as if he's completely satisfied, no bad intentions. But he's just showing like that. Actually, he has very bad intentions.
And
he just wants to... But just wants to win your confidence so that he can gobble you up. So these words are used in Shastra. Crocodiles, jackals. Jackal is, they hide away and come out at night. And they make a big noise, but their business is to find some leftover, some dead body and then eat that. So in the same way, the so-called swamis, they make a big noise, but their business is to pick up the remnants or the distorted remnants of the Vedic culture. And actually these so-called swamis who are cheating people, and then they take birth, as is fitting, as crocodiles, jackals, vultures, and so on. As an aside, as a going on the side a little bit here, as a side topic. Auxiliary, anusangik, another. I just learned yesterday that in Vishnu Purana it stated that people who keep dogs in their house, they go to hell. Which hell? Can you remember which one? There are so many hells. And then after that, they themselves become a dog. So now it's popular fashion in India to keep a dog, take the dog for a walk. And people are so foolish. We say this not to condemn them. They're already condemned by their foolish activities. But a devotee sees with compassion how people are misled and therefore preaches Krishna consciousness very strongly and very clearly so that people can use their intelligence to distinguish between what is right and what is wrong. If devotees don't point out what is right and what is wrong, then how can people ever know? Sometimes it's said, well, you just ask people to chant Hare Krishna, and then they'll automatically understand. But that is not the process of our acharyas. Kirtan is always to be accompanied by Shravanam. And Shravanam means Vedam Vasam Matravastu Shivadam Tapatrayon Mulanam, that hearing of Srimad Bhagavatam, which uproots the, is all auspicious, it's the essence of all, is the actual subject of the Vedas, and it uproots the three kleshas, or three miseries, three types of miseries.
So
Srimad Bhagavatam points out what is the fallacy of material so-called happiness. One cannot actually perform kirtan unless he has heard properly. If one is superficially chanting the name of Krishna but thinks that it's just the name of another god or that it's a mundane pious activity, then this is a nama aparada. One can never get love of Krishna by such chanting. A devotee has to be armed with knowledge, jnanasena, the sword of knowledge, so that he can distinguish between Krishna and the jiva. So that he can distinguish between Krishna and the demigods. So that he can distinguish between genuine devotees and bogus, so-called devotees. So that he can distinguish between karma, jnana, yoga, and bhakti. So that he can distinguish between shuddha bhakti, pure devotional service, and mixed devotional service. If a devotee can't distinguish between all these different tattvas, then he can never attain to pure devotional service. So it's another kind of mixed bhakti to to say that we won't teach people all these different things. Then we're only encouraging mixed devotional service or pseudo-devotional service. It is another kind of violence to the jiva to propose to teach bhakti without teaching bhakti. Without teaching bhakti. We'll teach bhakti without teaching Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam. Or we'll just teach the shlokas that hammer the ideas into the mind. Unless we hear again and again what is the actual message of Bhagavatam, then how will we overcome our attachments to all that which is not favorable for advancement in Krishna consciousness? I mean, for instance, Hindus tend to be very attached to demigod worship. So those who are taken to Krishna consciousness, unless we clearly delineate again and again, no, this is not one, this is an obstruction to pure devotional service, and how will they understand? We may say, well, they'll read it, they can read it in the books. But unless we stress what's in the books, they'll take it, well, it's just in the books, it's not very important. Hare Krishna. Is there any question?
Hare Krishna.
Bhakti gives rise to bhakti. Or to be more exact, bhakti is revealed by bhakti. Because bhakti, nitya siddha krishna prem shadha kabunoi, shravan adi shuddha chitte kariye udoi. Bhakti is not a product of anything. Bhakti is not even a product of bhakti. Because bhakti is the eternal condition of the soul. So bhakti, when we say bhakti causes bhakti, it's more accurate to say that bhakti reveals bhakti. That's why we don't think that we're converting anyone. We can't convert anyone to be a Vaishnava. Converted Vaishnava, there's no such thing. Everyone is already a Vaishnava. It's just a matter of reminding people.
So, how we can feel that perception short of
Right, Yeshang Tantakatam
Pavan. He's not mentioning any contact
with any that one who has performed punya karma, he can take two bhakti, duravataha. And so you're saying, well, it's not mentioned about a gyata sukriti or some such thing. So why don't we just take it to mean that by digging wells and opening dhamshalas and anakshetrams, that one can get bhakti? Why don't we take it like that? Did you understand? I don't really understand. Why don't you say it in Tamil? Put you on the spot there. Therefore, we have to understand everything through the acharyas. When the acharyas point out that this punya karma cannot mean digging wells and mundane pious activities, it may seem to be their a biased interpretation. But the major function of acharyas is to give shastra samanvaya, to show the harmony between different shastric statements. Now again we have bhaktya sanjataya bhaktya. So that appears to contradict yishan tantakatam papam jananam punya karmanam. It seems that by karma and jnana, bhajanti mam viravataha. By karma and jnana, one can take to rigid devotional service. But then we have bhaktya sanjatiya bhaktya. Bhakti gives rise to bhakti. So there appears to be a contradiction. So the acharyas have explained that this punya karma, that means that which is in relation to bhakti. And actually, if we consider it, it makes sense also. Because clearly, any amount of digging wells and opening dharamshalas and anakshetrams and planting trees on the sides of the road, these activities have no connection with bhakti. So how can they give rise to bhakti? An elephant doesn't give birth to a rabbit. Although even mundane punya karma is more likely to give rise to the agyata sukriti that leads to devotional service than is vikarma. Because even as an item of punya karma, one is supposed to offer respects to sadhus and by performing activities such as planting trees on the sides of the road, it's quite possible that at some point in time a sadhu, a genuine devotee, will also take the shade from the tree. However, the conclusion remains that janma koti sukritayana labhyate, that even millions of lifetimes of... And here sukriti is understood as mundane pious activities, that Krishna bhakti cannot be had even by millions of lifetimes of pious activities, devoid of any touch of bhakti. Therefore, the touch of pure devotees, the contact is so important. Bhaktistu bhagavad bhakta sangena parajayate. Bhakti is had from association with devotees. Bhaktya sanjatiya bhakti. Bhakti gives rise to bhakti. But where will you get the bhakti from in the first place? That has to come from devotees. Therefore, I'm requesting you to go on preaching pure devotional service by example and by precept, by achar and by prachar.
This
one.
The word atman, atmana.
Yeah.
Yet atma is in first place is translated as intelligence, and the next place is translated as paramatma.
Hmm.
What is the significance?
What do you mean, what's the significance? Atma can mean, Atma has various meanings, and it's according to context one has to. Here it's Atmana, by intelligence. By my own intelligence, Atmanam, of the Supersoul. The Supersoul is the subject of Dhyanam. So it's all quite acceptable translation. Ashrita Atmanatmanam. Taking shelter of Atmana, by intelligence, Atmanam, the Supersoul, Atmastam, situated within myself. So taking, oh, here Ashrita means taking shelter of the tree, actually. Could also mean taking shelter of the Paramatma. Could be read, I presume it could be read like that. Krishna tula bhagavat bibhu sarva shroi prati shloke prati akare nana artha koi. Srimad Bhagavatam is non-different from Krishna, it's all powerful and can give shelter to all. Every verse and every syllable has, in every verse and every syllable, it gives so many different meanings. So no doubt this could be interpreted in other ways, but which is acceptable as long as it doesn't contradict the principle of pure devotional service. Oh, then? Someone else had a question?
What is meant by Ishvara? Parameshwara, Paramapurusha, what is the difference?
Ishvara means controller. Parameshwara means the supreme controller. Parampurusha means the supreme male. So these are all synonymous terms. Ishvara means Parameshwara, Parameshwara. Ultimately it means Parameshwara. But because Parameshwara has given each jiva some small ability to control, therefore others may also sometimes be considered Ishvara. Therefore sometimes to emphasize who is actually the supreme controller, and to distinguish from lesser controllers, sometimes the term Parameshwara is used. That term is often applied to Lord Shiva, which is not inaccurate within a certain context. Within the context of material existence, Lord Shiva may be considered the supreme controller, because actually Vishnu is the supreme controller, but many functions of control within the universe he has designated to Lord Shiva. And the material energy is his wife. So, therefore, it's not inaccurate to call Lord Shiva Parameshwara. We should understand that this is true, but not in the full and complete sense, but only within the context of material existence. Because ultimately, Ishvara Parama Krishna.
So, when we offer Tulsi to Lord Krishna, can we accept it as prasada?
Should do. Not can do, should do.
So if they garland us with Tulsi leaves, can we accept it?
Oh, well, we accept garlands with flowers. That's the same, isn't it? When one wears a garland of flowers, it's understood that one is wearing as a sign of respect to the Lord, not as for personal decoration. That by wearing a garland of flowers that's offered to the Lord, one exhibits one's attitude of submission to Him. So the same goes for Tulsi Mala.
Mataji, can they have it?
Flowers in their hair?
Yeah, see, can they have in their hair? That's what she's asking.
It's not a general process. It's not. It's. I don't know of this being a shastrically recommended process. But generally, to keep anything on the upper part of the body like this, that means to show one's submission. Actually, the ladies, they should wear the flowers offered to the Lord in their hair, not for personal decoration, but as a sign of submission to the Lord. So in that respect, there's no harm in keeping tulsi also, although it's not a general process to do so.
So eating meat is prohibited, but in those days, Kshatriyas were allowed to eat meat. In some places it's mentioned, Bhima himself took meat.
Yeah, Kshatriyas, they didn't go to butcher shops. Whether halal or haram, they didn't go to butcher shops to kill in the forest. And then bring the animals and they would be offered, that would be offered in sacrifice, then they could take. So that may be a concession to the conditioned nature, because the conditioned soul has the, what is that? Panam striya dutam. Was it striyam suna? What is that in Bhagavatam? So these four. Dyutapanam striya sunam. Yatra papas chatur vidham. These are four kinds of sinful activities. Meat eating, illicit sex, or meat eating sex, it doesn't say illicit sex. Meat eating sex, gambling and intoxication. These sinful tendencies are there in the conditioned soul. So to regulate that and to turn it into a pious activity, the Vedic system is there. As far as bean eating meat, well, he's a transcendental kshatriya. Just like Garuda, he is a transcendental flesh eater. Jatayu. They're all Vaishnavas, but they are meat eaters. That is the prescribed food for that form. By doing so, in their case, they do not violate the principle of Krishna Bhakti. They do not do so out of a sense of hatred towards the creatures that they consume, nor to gratify their tongues, but as a matter of their service to the Lord. That is for them, that is not the standard process.
Will the Kshatriyas incur any sin because of that?
Sin will be incurred by Kshatriyas for hunting in the forest if they do so excessively or for personal enjoyment. So we'll finish there. Hare Krishna. Shrimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.